Good evening, everyone. I'd like to thank Brother Thomas for his words concerning the daily readings as a young brother, and I encourage him to continue with this work. I'm sure he will enjoy it as he goes along in the consideration of the scriptures and helping others to have love to follow suit and study the word. The exhortation that we received last Sunday, I think, can run along the side of my comments concerning our study of the Apostle Paul's letter to the Ecclesia at Corinth. We're going to deal with the second letter, and we shall this evening just give you an introduction to this letter, the background, the backdrop of it, which I feel is very important with a consideration of any of the Apostle Paul's letters. Now, it's been a long time in coming, but I think we finally have a wake-up. And I think that wake-up has been encouraged and brought on for more than one reasons. The Apostle Paul, when he wrote to many of the churches, that was a phrase that he constantly used, the need for the ecclesia to wake up and consider their situation at hand. For if they continue in that way, then it could be fatal and the downfall of the ecclesias, in which we know history has proved to be right, that they no longer exist as those ecclesias which he wrote to. And I think this reason for a wake-up for our ecclesia and the brotherhood throughout the world, and especially in our area, is the realization of what is happening around the religious circle of our city. Because we know over the past 2 or 3 weeks, we have mentioned in our newspapers and on other communications that, as some of our friends said to us recently, they have a real problem within the church, and especially the Anglican Church. And the outcome is that the consequence of this situation is, as we know, they have had to put many of the old churches on the block. They're up for sale. And it's quite easy for us, who maybe mingle from time to time with members of different churches, to be able to recognize the symptoms for this problem within the church, this sickness that exists within the churches around us. Because when we associate ourselves with some of those followers or part of the congregation, we realize that they have now, and they've had, this Laodicea approach to their study of the scriptures and to their worship to God Almighty. And we know that when we read of the messages to the churches and the book of Revelation concerning Laodicea, who is neither hot nor cold, we remember strong language is used by Christ to that particular church when he says, "You, Laodicea, are in a sick condition. You are wretched. Thou art wretched. You are miserable. You are poor. And you are blind." And the reason for this is, within the churches, and the possibility can be a part of our makeup, if we continue maybe not taking care of a condition of our ecclesia, is for the lack of deep spiritual education. It all boils down to the necessity of the education as we go through the passing of the years within the congregation. And this we see it with the lack of education within the churches, because we know that in the original, when the church was established way back in AD 100 and 200, the Catholic Church and the leaders of that church proclaimed to their congregations that you leave it to us, we'll do the studying of the scriptures, we'll tell you what you should do, how you should worship the Almighty, and all those guidelines. And so we know that down through the ages, there is now flaws within the churches, and there is a problem. And some of the members that we associate with the churches, the Baptist Church and the Anglican Church and others, many of those members, when we discuss the scriptures with them,
they have a difficulty even locating the books of the Bible. Now, we know this isn't always necessarily directed to them, because some of us also have a little problem finding some of the minor prophets of the Bible. But these are individuals to the extent that you mentioned Genesis and Revelation, Genesis and Exodus, they seem to have difficulty of locating it in their scriptures. So they accept, which is another breakdown of the structure of the churches, that they accept the teaching of their church, but when you confront them, they have no backup to it in the way of scriptural evidence to support it. And so this is, they accept the tradition of their fathers, but they have no depth of the good soil of the word. They cannot prove when they say, well, we believe this, they cannot prove what is right or wrong. So all this brings in with it the foreign teaching into the church as their structure of the church. And with it comes, with it is the people's new ideas coming in, and you have the evil things creeping into the church. So now the big question is, and we have friends when they have moved three times in a desire to worship in a church, three times because of the order of service, those who perform the service, and such like. They do not approve of the conduct. And we are grateful to this, that our friends recognize this problem, and they are seeking for an assembly of believers whom they feel have the understanding of the truth, and they can join them and be a part of them. And so you get the distortion in the structure of the church. And so you get this willingness to do those, get this willingness of the people to do those things what are not approved of God. And so within some of the churches that we know of, they have the women priests, which we know is contrary to the scriptures, especially the teachings of the Apostle Paul to the churches. They have homosexuals who, we know, in attending out of necessity some church services, that conduct the service. They are standing in the place of Jesus, which we know is contrary and despicable to God in heaven for allowing this. And so it continues in this way. And what we're saying is this is why the doors of the churches are being closed. Because people now are getting more educated, more understanding, being able to look into the format of the church and what is said in scripture, and they see it as folly, they see it as something which is not reliable, not tangible, and they don't want to be a part of it. And yet, whilst we look upon the churches, and we give the survey of their weaknesses, we must agree that the churches are very good in other things. The churches are very good, and we get criticized for it. I do as an individual, representing my ecclesia. They are good in as much as the churches do very good work within the neighborhood, within countries, and assisting, helping out with those who are hungry, those who are homeless, and those who need help. We have to commend the community, we have to commend the congregation of the churches for this. And we know, we don't expose, and we don't lay out in great detail placards the work that we do. The Christadelphian Brotherhood is to be commended for the work that they do in the missionary field. They're to be commended in the way they help out in the community with individuals that we don't always know about. So we do this, but as the scripture says, we try to do it in a way where the left hand doesn't know what the right hand does. And we get criticized for this. And yet we know that this is not the priority of our service to Jesus Christ. We know the scriptures tell us that we must do this, as Jesus said, when he depicts the scene of the judgment seat, when those who will come forth and say, I have done this and that in your name, Jesus, But we know that Jesus says, yes, but when I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was in prison, did you visit me? And so we know this is a necessity. The scripture also tells us forthright that this is not the priority in our service to God and to Jesus Christ. Our service to Jesus Christ, as we know, is to provide for them the bread from heaven. Because if we know the provisions of this life, we can give it to them. An individual lives to 75 years or more. Yet this is little compared that if we feed people with the bread of the word, it can give them everlasting life and extension of life. And so we see it in this particular way. Now, as an introduction to our study of the Ecclesia of Corinth, you may say, well, why are you speaking in this vein? Why is your introduction presented in this way? The reason is, and it is a serious one, and that is, I belong to this ecclesia now for 50 or 55 years, and I can tell you that 50 years ago, for those few who are here will support me, that this ecclesia was dying on the vine. This ecclesia, back in the 50s, was in a terrible situation, and it could have finished up, as with many of the churches around us, closing the door because of the lack of attendance, because of the lack of people who were energized to keep it alive. And we don't like to dwell on that, but this is, as the Apostle Paul, when he wrote his letter, he could foresee such a condition. And we're told that he said to them, I am writing to you with tears in my eyes, with pain, because as a father to the ecclesia, he could foresee what could happen if they continue in this way of service to the God. And so it is a sad situation. And not many brothers and sisters who are so emotionally involved and tied up and concerned with their ecclesia as the Apostle Paul. It is a very sickening thing to be able to see, as I have done, a brother or brethren with tears in their eyes over the conditions of their own ecclesia. And so we know that we have to speak this way. We have to read the Apostle Paul's letters to understand the tragedy that can happen to ecclesia. And you say, well, is this so? And some of us have blinkers on our eyes within this general area because we're not exposed to the whole brotherhood. We don't go and mingle with other ecclesias. But if you travel, as of the last few years, if you travel into other countries like England and into Australia and New Zealand and those countries, you will see that we're not, fortunately we are in a good position, this ecclesia, but they're not in the same, we're not in the same depth of despair as they are, but there is deep concern in countries like England, New Zealand and Australia, and of late I have a letter from Singapore, and they have, though it is of small ecclesias, they have many brethren and sisters traveling through that area, and they're confronted with problems that they have to deal with for those who visit them, because they come, as with Corinth, they come into this area, come into another country, and they want to bring ideas and to for the ecclesia to accept that are foreign to God's ways. And so we have these things happening within the ecclesia, and we can see, especially in England, they do not have the young brothers and sisters who are coming forward with enthuse to take up the challenge of the cross. And these gaps with the older brothers and sisters dying, we don't have these young people coming up to fulfill the gap. And so the reason why we introduced it in this way, the study of this Ecclesia of Corinth, because These conditions were in this city, in this ecclesia of Corinth, and it was a sad situation. And we know, I think it was 2 years or 3 years ago, I forget now, but we walked the streets of the ancient city of Corinth by the Ephemus, that thin strip of land in which Corinth is on. We walked there relatively along the same streets as the Apostle Paul walked. And all that's left of that city that was is just ruins, where the archaeologists have tried to revive the city as it was. And you're able to walk along these streets, you're able to see the stores and the houses that were there, but there's no ecclesia there. There's no ecclesia there. It's the same when we went to Laodicea, same when we went to Philadelphia, same when we went to Thessalonica. There's no ecclesia there. There's a few maybe believers, those who we recognize as brothers and sisters of Christ there, but very, very few. And so this is the wake-up call that Paul is writing to this Corinth, that he doesn't want to see that happen to them. And we know the warning is amplified by the prophets. Brother Thomas spoke this evening about Israel and their position before their God. And we know how many times that they didn't give God the full service that was expected of them. And we realize the terrible thing, the tragic thing that happened within the ranks of those families, within those tribes. And so we know that when the prophet Malachi, he was exhorting to the church or the ecclesia of his day. And we know that speaking on behalf of God, he said, as the conditions could be in the brotherhood today, he says, yes, you service me. You have your hall, you have your place of worship, temple, and you carry out all the things according to the law. But he said, it's a half-hearted effort. There isn't the enthusiasm, there isn't the zeal, there isn't the first love within the sacrifice. So you know what happened. We know what happened when God said to them in Malachi chapter 1 verse 10, he said to them, shut the doors. That's what he said. The service that you were giving me is not worthy of it. It's a polluted service. It's a fallacy. And it's no good for me. I will not accept it. It gives a bitter taste in my mouth. So close the doors. And that is what has happened within our own neighborhood and throughout the world, where these places of worship are being closed down because of the service that they're giving and for the lack of the first love that was there when the ecclesia was established many years ago. And so we know this was the case even with the temple. We remember the temple within Jerusalem. We know so well that God was disappointed with the service there. And finally, in AD 70, we know that he saw to it that that temple should no longer stand. But as Jesus told his apostles, remember, when they said to him, well, Jesus, look at this wonderful place of worship. And we have a wonderful place of worship, a very good dwelling place in which we can come here in comfort. And so Jesus, they said to him, look at this wonderful temple built. So much money was put into it, so beautiful, and so it must have been. But Jesus told them that that temple is going to be broken down into rubble, and a new temple is going to come into its place. And we know that temple was, as he was saying later on, the temple would be the living body of believers who would believe in his name. And so this was the exhortation that the Apostle Paul gave to the ecclesias in his day, which is now, wherefore let him who thinketh he standeth be careful lest he fall. And so that should be the war cry of the brotherhood throughout the world today. It should have been our war cry to challenge us constantly when he said, let him that thinketh he stand be careful, lest he fall. And so by studying this second letter of Thessalonians, We should by rights call it the third letter of Thessalonians. You know, in your Bible, you have the first letter to Thessalonians, you have the second letter to Thessalonians, but this one we're studying by rights should be called the third letter to Thessalonians. We'll explain that a little later on. But we'll quickly tell you the reason for it is because there was, before the first, as we know it, the first letter, there was another letter which Paul had written. So the first one technically is the second one, and the second one should be the third one. But we'll speak about that a little later on, because we want to this evening just give an introduction to this study. And so when we do get around to studying the second letter to the Ecclesia of Corinth, what we do by the study, we lift the roof off the Ecclesia, and we look inside, and we see all those brothers and sisters. But what we do, if we look closely, we can see fractures and flaws in the foundation of this. And we know that it would cause these fractures and the flaws, which maybe it's like a house, like the house we lived in many years ago down on the waterfront. They did some blasting by the side of our house. Some of the rock formation had to be removed and all that kind of stuff. And there were slight cracks in the foundation of our house, which didn't seem to be anything to worry about. As I said, they came and expected, oh, don't worry about it. It's just a very small fracture. You won't worry about it. But as the years went by, this fracture became larger and of concern to us. And so that was the same situation as we look at the Ecclesia of Corinth. When we lift the roof off, we look into it and we see these fractures, small fractures within the foundation and in the structure. But Paul, as we know, having the gift of the Holy Spirit, having been able to see things far more advanced than many of the congregation, he could foresee that these were going to broaden, and in time would cause the ecclesia to fall and be lost and only known by name. So Paul gives this wake-up call with tears, seeing the tragedy that could happen. Now, in an introduction, I don't want to spend too much time on details of where Corinth was and all that kind of stuff, because maybe most of you know the location of Corinth. You know the missionary journeys of the Apostle Paul, and you know the history of the Rome and of Greece at that time. But it won't hurt to have a little bit of information with us to give a bit of a garment to cover the subject at hand. Now, we do know, and it's an interesting study, and all brothers and sisters should study a little bit of the Roman history, the Roman Empire, and of the Greek Empire, because this, for the New Testament, especially to deal with the Acts of the Apostles onwards, is the backdrop for most of the things that we deal with and study. So it is good for us to have some understanding of especially the conditions and who ruled, who controlled, who influenced in the time of the Apostle Paul, Peter, and the others. So we have learned that the Romans divided the country of Greece into two parts. The Romans divided this Greece as we know it today in the two parts, Macedonia and Achaia. And we all know the Macedonia. I think we spoke about this a few weeks ago concerning who was the man from Macedonia. And so, but Achaia was the largest of the two. And this is where the city of Corinth was the capital of Achaia. It was the center of the government and commerce. It was a very important city, and it was situated on the great trade route between Rome, Ephesus, and the Syrian Antioch. So we can see, if we see the picture now of this situation of this country where it is, a very important place, this trade route between Rome, Ephesus, and the Syrian Antioch. You can imagine the traffic that went through there. You can imagine the people that traveled through there and lived there, resided there, and the things that they brought with them. Now, Corinth, as we know, has gone through Achaia, and Greece has gone through many wars over the through history, and we're told that in BC 44, Julius Caesar reconstructed the city of Corinth. It was back in 146 BC that it had been previously been attacked, defeated, and as we know, left in ruins. When Julius Caesar recreated this city of Corinth, he used it as a colony to send all those retirees from his own Roman army. He colonized this general area. And so all those Roman veterans were sent there, retired there, and it became to such an extent that there was, at the time of the Apostle Paul, 250 free men, those who were being given the freedom of Rome, and they resided there. There were also 400,000 slaves, and that was a situation in many parts of the world at that time, the Roman Empire. We know within Rome there were twice as many slaves as there was citizens. And the reason I mention this is because when we look into the makeup of the congregation of Corinth, there were many slaves who were drawn to the teaching of the scriptures. They're attracted to them. Slaves were attracted to the message of the gospel, just the same as our missionary workers have quite a good results from preaching, because these people in those countries have very little else to hold on to, tangible, and anything to look forward to. So the kingdom coming upon the earth is a wonderful appeal to them as something to look forward to. In this city of Corinth, we're talking about the influence of the world within the congregation. And this is the thing, as we know, we have to be aware of constantly, of the inroads of the influence of the things of the world. And we're all familiar with this. We've had exhortations on it. We learn from the scriptures in this way. But this was the situation with Corinth. And this is why some of the problems were there at that particular time when Paul was writing to them. They had 12 temples in the city. They had 12 temples within the city of Corinth. And we know that one of the most adored and one that was attended mostly was the temple of Venice, the temple of Venice, and Aphrodite, as we know, who was supposed to be the goddess of love. And we know that this Aphrodite was there. They worshipped her, and it wasn't alone that, but the people, as we know, while they worshipped her, they also worshipped the fact that they were lovers of themselves. Now, when you go to the Acts of the Apostles 18, and you look upon the congregation and the makeup of the city of Corinth, we know that a large number of Jews immigrated to this area or were sent there because of the edict of Claudius in Acts 18 verse 2. And I found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome and came unto them. And so on in this particular way. It's also interesting to see that this city had two harbors. And these two harbors, as we know, spewed out many people from all different types of countries. And when they came into this city and established themselves, they brought a lot of luggage with them. And this luggage was the teachings of other religions and the teachings of the Greeks. And we know how this influenced them. This how troubled the Apostle Paul was, these Greek teachings, the Gnostics, And those Jews, zealous Jews, who considered Paul and others as preaching of a false Christ and such like. So there's this conflict. There's conflict with the within the ecclesia of those influenced by the Greek teachings, thinking the Gnostic way of teaching, and that a crucified Christ was folly in the eyes of the Greeks. The Greeks just could not see how people would worship a man that had been crucified upon the cross. And we know this was so because when you go through Greece and you go into different areas and you're going through the places that have been restored by the archaeologists, you go into these large areas and they're called gymnasiums. But actually, they were universities. But the emphasis was on physical education. So the devotion to the where they were called universities in the way of teaching, the teaching of the different, as we know, the different Greek philosophers, such as Plato and Socrates and the other Aristotle and so on. The teaching was there, but the emphasis was on the athlete with their physique and physical prowess. And to the Greeks, this is what they centered on. It was concentrated on this. And we have the Olympics today, or the commencing tomorrow, and we can see the thousands, millions of dollars that are being spent on this. We can see that the whole world is looking inwards to our general area of what is going on. It's unbelievable when you think of the concentration, the man hours, and the millions of dollars that are being poured into this, and it all to the glory of man ability in sports and physique in this way. So this is what has happened in this way. And so this is what the Apostle Paul addressed the Ecclesia of Corinth concerning the teaching of the Greeks. And we remember, we won't be going into the first letter because we want to concentrate on the second letter, but we know that when Paul was concerned about the wisdom of the Greeks that was influenced in the Ecclesia, you remember when he wrote the first letter, and he says in chapter 1 at verse 18, he says, for the preaching of the cross, is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it is the power of God. And he continues on. He dwells on that situation in the beginning of this letter. He said, but we preach Christ crucified. We preach Christ crucified. That is the one that we look up to. That is the one that we respect and would follow in his footsteps. And he said, but we preach Christ crucified unto the Jews that we're confronted with, opposers, the thorn in the flesh, unto the Jews, it's a stumbling block. It gets in their way of their understanding. They want to remove it. But he said, unto the Greeks, it is foolishness. Unto the Greeks, it is foolishness. And so we know that he continues in this vein of talking on this particular subject of the wisdom of the Greeks and the wisdom of those who would follow the crucified Christ. He said, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God hath chosen, as we know, he continues, those who we would not choose to be leaders of a community and such like. And so the ranks of the ecclesia, if we look into this ecclesia, if we could go back in time and sit in the congregation when a service is in progress, we would naturally see a variation in the audience. We would see slaves over there, and we would see Greeks there, and we would see Jews there in this particular way. And there was an order. There was an order of worship in the ecclesia in those days. We know that when we come into our ecclesia, the Corson's always sit in the middle. The MacPherson's always sit over there. Clover's always sit over there. Kirk's always sit over there. which is all right, because you're always assured of your seat unless somebody favors your seat at that time. But this was the case in the ecclesias in the days gone by, in a different way. In the synagogue, as they do today, in the synagogue, they sat according to their trade. And so if you was a farmer, you would sit over there. If you were a fisherman, you would sit over there, and so on. And this is the way it was. They sat their trades. And this is quite possible how that Paul met Priscilla and Aquila, because they were of the same trade. And so it is thought that when Paul went into the synagogue, he located immediately those who were tent makers and of that craft, and he would sit, he would go and sit into that block. And this is where, it's a possibility, scripture doesn't tell us that, but those who study the order of the synagogues over the years, they seem to suggest that this is the way it was, and this is the way that, Paul came to notice and found association with Aquila and Priscilla. Now, as we say, we have these number of people, and the Apostle Paul, as we know, had his high and lows in converting people. But we remember, that, do we not, that one of his most, one of his notable conversions, as we remember, was the ruler of the synagogue. We remember, do we not, in Acts, where we're told there that it says he'd been preaching in the synagogue, he ran into opposition, he decided to leave there and now direct his full attention to the Gentile. He saw that he was throwing his pearls upon those who didn't appreciate it, and he moved away from the synagogue and he went into a home close by the synagogue. And so one of his, as he seemed to recognize, one of his most pleasing converts was Crispus, as we, it is recorded in Acts chapter 18 and at verse 5. And Crispus, the chief ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his house, and many of the Corinthians hearing believed and were baptized. So there was this influence. This man who the people already appreciated and respected, he now converted to the thinking of the Apostle Paul, believing that Jesus of Nazareth was the Christ. He influenced his own family, and they became baptized, and he also took with him, it would appear, took with him many of the Corinthians who were believed and baptized. So we can see there was those good, the good element within the ecclesia. We can almost see, and we must do this with all us that is draw our exhortation, we can also see how that God will use us if we are dedicated to the preaching of the gospel, and not alone the preaching of the gospel, but living of the gospel. The people recognized this man Crispus was a man who was zealous, sincere in believing and worshiping the God of their forefathers. And they accepted the fact that this man was willing to listen, this man Crispus was willing to listen to others, the Apostle Paul, and he'd been influenced. He now, his eyes were open to that which was the light of Jesus Christ, and they followed him this way. So we have this power within us, assisted by God, used by God, to influence people. And we're going to talk about this as we go into Corinthians, because I think as individuals, we underestimate the position that we're in. We underestimate the power that we have to influence people. And I believe that this may be held against us, that we haven't utilized this energy and this power that is invested into us to bring other people to Jesus Christ. And so within this ecclesia also, as we read, as we found out in the first letter, we found that there was a whole congregation of sisters, ladies, who had come to the truth. And women do seem to be appeal to the beauty of the scriptures and the understanding it, and to be attached to this way. So it is thought, and it's supported by the fact, that when Paul wrote to this ecclesia, he had a lot of a lot to do with talking to the sisters, because we know they presented him a lot of problems. I'm sure the brethren did as well, but in a different direction. But we know that he had to deal with, in the letter, he had to deal with the problems that are created because of these ladies and these sisters concerning a few things, such as the wearing of hats and the order of service and all that kind of stuff. Moving throughout the country, of late, I've met up with sisters who have this difficulty. I've also met up with sisters who feel they should be in a position to serve the bread and wine as well. So we have this. And I'm not putting the finger at sisters at this time. I'm only saying to you what the Apostle Paul had to deal with. He had so many avenues in which he had to try to cover and deal with. He had these Jews, he had these Gentiles, and he had these Greeks coming in with all the different ideas. And he had these inner problems that he had to deal with. So we understand how it is, because this ecclesia was in growing pains. This ecclesia was still getting the milk of the word, and he was trying to give them the meat of the word. This ecclesia was not very old. This ecclesia may have only been about 10 years old, and maybe a little more. So he had to deal with it. And this problem with the sisters is understandable, because within Corinth and within these temple worship, the women had a great influence within those temple worship. They pretty well control things as they go. And this had an influence upon all the ladies, not all the ladies, but many of those ladies within Corinth. And now they became sisters. And now they felt that they should also be in such a position to be able to be involved in this thing, which was good. And Paul would encourage, but in the right direction. And so, with this grim picture of the city of Corinth, with all with the people who came in there with the vice and new religions and cults and everything that are coming in, it was a great challenge for the Apostle Paul. And so, with this grim picture of this city, we would say, well, why did God send Apostle Paul, Titus, and Timothy into this environment? Why didn't he send it somewhere else where the people would be welcome them and they would accept the truth without all this problem? And the Apostle Paul, we know, came to Corinth. He'd already been to Athens. And in Athens, he had a terrible time, because we know that he debated with the philosophers, the Stoics, and all those. And they were clever. The Greeks were taught as young men to debate. That was part of the university teaching, was the ability to debate on any other subject. And they spent hours doing it. And there's a tact in debating. If you debate with a person, there's a method in which, even though you may have the weaker knowledge of your subject, you can defeat your opponent by the way you approach it and deal with it. And this is the way the Apostle Paul, when he went to Athens, he debated with these. And he couldn't get anywhere with them. He was just like Jesus, who could not bend the thinking of the Pharisee his way. And so Paul, when he left Athens, he was a very depressed, disappointed brother. And he went to Corinth, as we know, and he was almost like Jeremiah. Let me go into the wilderness and forget this whole work altogether. But we remember it was that God told him in a vision. God told him in a vision, as we know. He says, it's written down here in chapter 8. Then the Lord, recognizing Paul in this situation, depressed, afraid, disappointed, a sick man physically and spiritually at this time, the Lord came to him God did to Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he said, then spake the Lord to Paul in the night by a vision. And God said to him, Paul, you don't want to come into this city of Corinth, because you know it's going to be worse than Athens. You know you're going to be opposed by all the factors of the different groups, and it's going to be very difficult for you. And for a period of time, you're on your own. But listen to what he said. Paul, he said, be not afraid, but speak and hold not thy peace. I am with thee, and no man shall set on thee to hurt thee. For I, says God, have much people in this city. Here again is a minute exhortation for all of us. Many of us meet up with people in our business or traveling or work or even shopping. We meet up with people and we talk to them and say, that person, if I had the opportunity, it's not worth talking to him about the truth. He wouldn't make a brother, a good brother, sister Christ. We deal with people like we do when we're canning food. We take fruit and say, that's worth preserving. This one, we throw out. That's the way we deal. I have that problem sometimes. And I talk to somebody, and Sylvia says, that's a good opportunity. You should. We're on to a subject. Why don't you get around to the subject of Christ coming out? And I said, nah, not interesting. They won't be interesting. Which is wrong, because Paul, when he went into Corinth, I'm sure he said, I'm coming here, but I'm not going to have too much in the way of resort, because I know the people. I know who's here. I know these Romans that are settled here, and they are set in their ways. I know the people here. I know these Jews that are dogging me, the thorn in the flesh. I know them, and I know the Greeks. I've had the Greeks in Athens. I couldn't handle them there. And so it was in this way that Paul said, but God said, I have much people in this city. And God may be saying this of us. I have much people in this city. How many days do you go by without saying or letting somebody know that you're a follower of Christ? Now, when we go into the study of the second letter to Corinth, you'll find that the Apostle Paul, every move he makes, the first thing he tells them is that they know, I am an ambassador for Jesus Christ. And when I was talking to Brother Tennant one time about this subject, one thing about difficulties talking to people about, he said, you know what I do, Brother Matt? The first thing I do when I meet up with anybody, before I leave that individual, I make sure he knows who I am, what I believe, and what I stand for. And I thought, knowing Brother Tennant, he could do that, and he could be commended for it. And this is the way the Apostle Paul was, and this is the way he influenced the people. After he'd been there a few weeks, everybody knew who that man was walking down the street. Everybody knew, both Jew and Greek, what he stood for. Everybody knew what he would stand, that he would not divert from his way of walk at that particular time. So it is, brothers and sisters, and we learn a lot about this man Paul in this letter, more than any other epistle, because when we study the second letter, we see through the power of the word of the outpouring of this man. He was as his Lord and Master, who said, I am willing to spend and to be spent. And so I think we're going to leave it at that, because we are next week, all being well, we'll go into this study of the second letter. I want you may, we have a group, as most of you know, we have a group around on Mondays in our house, about 8 or 9 outsiders, and Brother Bob and Di support us on this, and we've been doing it for a number of years, but we use a method of teaching them, but over the past year, 2 years, Bob and myself decided that we're doing a lot of talking, but these people are not remembering too much. Nothing to do with Bob's teaching, it could be mine, but they don't. So what we did, we introduced homework, and so we give them an assignment every week, you know, that if we're studying. We're studying Thessalonians right now. So we give them an assignment to read the book to begin with, and then locate a section in which seems to influence them or that they don't understand. And they have to talk about it. By doing this, they are now remembering. Because as you know, any brother knows who gives a talk, he's the one who is more beneficial to him than the audience because he's done all his homework and that. The reason I mention this is because I want you to do a little bit of homework. Because when you read the second letter of Paul to the Corinthians, we go in the order of chapter 1 to chapter 13. Now, if you study that letter, you'll find there's a problem with it. And the problem is that it's not in chronological order. That letter is not in chronological order. But so what has happened, those people who have collected these letters, a manuscript many years ago, they felt that this particular letter had got mislaid in sections in different locations. So what they say here is, because this letter is the most severe letter that the Apostle Paul wrote to any ecclesia, they say the order of the chapters is incorrect. The severe letter that he wrote is in from chapter 9 to chapter 13. That's the original letter. And then from chapter 1 to chapter 9 is the reconciliation. So in a way, I'm putting this to you, so when I come next week, I want you to do a little homework and see if you think that is correct. Not all Bible students agree with it, but if you study that, it would appear that this is way. Because if you read chapter 9 to chapter 13, you'll see there the language is completely different to the first 9 chapters. So this letter, which is the most severe of all the letters, I think is contained chapter 9 to 13, the language. He does this. He sends this letter. He wished he'd never sent it. He sent it with Titus. He anguished every living moment of the day until Titus came, because he wanted to hear from Titus how this letter affected the people. And he couldn't wait for Titus to come back. He went to him. He went to Philippi. He went into Macedonia. He went to meet Titus before he came here. And he wanted to know the reaction to this letter. And so it's in there. So just an interesting part of the study of Corinthians.